What's going on, guys? Welcome to another episode of the Clean Libertarian Podcast, your one-stop destination for everything involving the war on drugs and what the libertarians want to do about it. Here we are, 2021. How are you guys doing? Is it better yet? Is it safe to go outside? You know, has the coronavirus gone away? Doubt it. No? Okay. I don't know. Here we are. You know, this is going to be another year. I can promise you that. I don't think that because, you know, one full rotation around the sun has occurred that everything's going to magically get better. 2020 was a shit show. It was tough. Tough for all of us, man. Here in Oklahoma, we've done a little bit better than other places I've heard of. Like, we've never really had comprehensive lockdowns or, you know, hardcore mask mandates, at least not in the state level. So I count myself pretty lucky, but I know that some of you listening to this, you know, you have a different experience, and my heart goes out to you, especially those of you in the recovery community who've had to watch, you know, actual meeting places close indefinitely as a result. But you know what? It, just because maybe the world around us isn't going to change doesn't mean we can't change ourselves, right? Here we are in a new year. We can absolutely be a better version of ourselves for the next 12 months than we were the last 12. And that's what I hope to achieve myself. Here's the thing. I'm really going to try and not put this in terms of it being a New Year's resolution. Like, yours truly has gained more weight. I'm the heaviest I've ever been. I am the quintessential fat guy, and I want to change that. You know, I want to eat better and exercise more, and I want that to be a lifestyle change. I don't want it to be because, you know, it's the spirit of the season, you know, of New Year's resolution and all that cliche. Like, I genuinely want to do it for myself and for my daughter and for my wife and just be a better version of me, right? And so no matter what you're doing or you know, what changes you're trying to make in your own personal life, just know that there's a chubby dude in Oklahoma who's right there struggling with you. And feel free to reach out anytime you want. And so, yeah, I hope that wherever you're at, you're good, you're happy, you're healthy, and you want to see some change. You know, you want to be a little bit better, and I applaud you for that. So with it being a new year, I figured that what better way to kick off the podcast season of 2021 than to bring this podcast back to its roots, and that's sharing another story of recovery with you guys. This is a interview I did with a friend on Twitter. His name is Benevolus, and Benevolus, he is someone who's also in the recovery community, and he's kind of, you know, dipping his toe into the libertarian portion of Twitter, you know, and we just clicked, man. We hit it off, and I just wanted to have him come on and share his story. And there's a lot of stuff that he talks about, and not just the pretty stuff. Like, this guy, you know, he gets gut level honest with us. And I hope if you're listening to this, maybe you can identify with some of that. And maybe you can identify with some of the victories that he's had as well. And so with that, I'm going to go ahead and wrap it up and bring on Benevolus. All right. And I'm here with Benevolus. How you doing, sir?
Fantastic, man. How are you?
Doing well. Really glad to have you on. Just a brief rundown to the audience about how we met. You know, you and I kind of followed each other on Twitter, and every now and again, I'll talk about, you know, recovery and recovery based things. And, you know, you and I kind of, we clicked on that level. And, that's kind of why I wanted to bring you on today, is to share with us your story. You are the first guest of 2021. So going into a new year, and we're setting the tone right with this thing. Beyond that, is there any kind of introduction you want to give yourself?
No, not really. Just grateful to be here. Thankful to have the opportunity to share my story in any capacity at all. I'm grateful for another year started sober, and the opportunity to you know, bring it in like that. So I appreciate you having me on.
Absolutely, man. Now, how did it start for you? That's where it all, that's where we all begin on our story. Like where did, you know, you start using and kind of find your thing?
So being in recovery, especially if you go the route, like, you're a 12 stepper. I mean, I don't.
Yeah. Try.
Okay. Yeah. When you go the route we do, you hear a lot of stories, you know, speaker meetings, stuff like that. And, I've heard so many where people start out talking about, you know, I started at 12, 13, 10, you know, getting a drink of dad's beer or whatever. But man, mine's a little bit away from that because my dad is a drug addict and alcoholic, and I didn't want to be like him. So I was bound and determined in my younger years not to be like that, which is a little bit ironic that I ended up being that way anyway. But when I was in middle school, I guess I kind of latched onto something else, which was basketball. I guess it kind of became my addiction. It's funny. People like me use things addictively, no matter what it is. I guess it's just kind of the personality trait or whatever. But through school, it was basketball and then guitar before I ever started using anything. But I was the first time I ever drank anything was the day before I turned 20. And I got really drunk really fast. And I remember thinking, and I even told a friend of mine that I drank with the next day. I was like, I don't understand why people do this. But I was really drunk. I was really hungover. I don't remember a whole lot from it, except that I just really didn't enjoy it that much. And I didn't do anything again for a couple years. So I was like 22 when I actually started drinking on a regular basis. And then from there, it was, you know, every other weekend, which moved into every weekend. I started playing music in bars, and that kind of upped the game a little bit, you know. The thing that I guess really set it off as far as what made me want to move in that direction is I grew up, you know, in a really religious family. You know, I got uncles that are preachers and evangelists and music ministers and all that. I think we were in church pretty much any time a door was open. You know, as I got older, I kind of realized a lot of stuff wasn't quite the way it was made out to be to me. And then, you know, a lot of anger and resentment towards my dad for the way I grew up, you know, didn't have to grow up like that. You know, I was just really angry. And I was also dating this girl, and when she broke up with me, that was just kind of like the last straw, you know. I had put all these eggs in this one basket, and I had all my trust in God there, as you know, if this don't work out, God, this is it. And then when it didn't work out, I was like, all right, you know, you didn't come through for me, so I'm not gonna bank on you anymore. And I just kind of went in the other direction. So after that, it just kind of went downhill pretty quick, man. From 22, when I started drinking pretty regular, I went from that, started added weed to it pretty quick. And within a year, I was doing something just about every day, whether it was smoking weed or drinking. And then, like I said, I started playing music in the bars and wherever else. And I started doing that kind of as a part-time as a living. I was still working, but I was, you know, doing that as well and working 4 or 5 days a week and then trying to play music on the weekends. You know, I needed something to kind of help through that. So started adding some pills to the mix and, you know, it just kind of became part of the lifestyle that I was living, and it kept me from having to deal with all the emotions I never wanted to really deal with.
Right.
So, that's, I guess it's a long version of how it started for me and got me into the using of everything. So,
well, that's kind of like, that's our collective story, right? I mean, anybody that comes in, you know, and I'll hammer this every time somebody shares their story, cause I don't like hearing it in the rooms, is whenever we tell people that your worst day clean is better than your best day high. And that's just bullshit because it was fun, right? It was fun until it wasn't,
yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
And so, and there's plenty of good times, and I've had some pretty bad days in recovery. You know, life doesn't just stop happening cause I picked up a coin, you know, we still got to keep experiencing those things, but yeah, man. So on the relationship thing, dude, like that takes a lot of us down a certain trajectory. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That one in and of itself. So like, have you come to kind of terms with what that meant for you at the time? Or was that just something you kind of worked through on your own? Like, how did that look like for you?
Yeah. See, back then, I had this idea of what God's will was for me. And it's funny because now my perspective on God's will is completely different of how it was back then. See, back then, I thought God's will was whatever I wanted. I thought basically if I prayed for it and had this desire for it, then I should get it, you know? And
right.
So when I got my mindset on something and I really prayed and put my heart and soul into it, and then it didn't work out, which is that relationship with that one specific person. Like I said, all my eggs were there in that one basket, and all this other stuff I had found out about these other people that I had went to church with for years, you know, these people I grew up with in youth group and everything else. And I had really put a lot of my heart and soul into it. As far as going through school and everything, I didn't go to parties. I didn't drink. I really tried to live the Christian life, you know, in my head back then, the way that I thought we were supposed to live it. And I thought they were too. And so I found out that, you know, they were like all hooking up and having parties and stuff like this. I don't know if I was more mad that they didn't invite me or, you know, mad that, you know, that they weren't living the same way I was. I don't know. I don't know what it just, it was kind of just like a culmination of all that. It was just so much anger, and then anger at my dad, angry at my position, you know, growing up in a family of, you know, being like the only one of my cousins who grew up poor, you know, me and my brother. And it, because of my dad, you know, and it just, you know, I finally just let all that frustration go and I put it into substances, you know, booze and weed first, and it just progressed from there.
So. Yeah, man. For a time in our lives where we really desperately need good coping skills and don't have any, drugs tend to fit the bill pretty good, man. They do one hell of a job, you know? That, you know, addicts and alcoholics, we have this thing where we just hate raw, unfiltered reality. It doesn't matter. It doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing. Like experiencing like extreme joy, we want to hold on to that and keep it. And so we start, you know, I mean, that can be in and of itself a reason to get loaded, you know? So yeah, I mean, I identify a lot with that, you know? So it got bad. What was that moment in your life and in your using where you're like, this has gone too far, it has to stop?
It actually came probably a year before I actually stopped. I was at a friend's house, and she had a daughter who was like 8 or 9 years old at the time. And the door on the bathroom didn't lock, and nobody was there when I first went in, you know, and I was just kind of crashing on their couch because I didn't have anywhere to live at the time. And I mean, this was a pretty pitiful place to be anyway. I mean, it was just like piles of clothes laying everywhere, boxes of trash. And I mean, it's just a 9-year old shouldn't have been living there. I mean, we'll just put it that way. But regardless of that, you know, there's an 8 or 9 year old living here. in this place as well. And I'm upstairs in this bathroom, there's only bathroom there. And, you know, but I got my rig loaded up and I'm about to stick it in my arm, or well, I'd gotten it in my arm. And she ran upstairs before I could even register what was about to happen. She busts through the door and here I am, you know, firing a shot of heroin in my arm, you know, and it, the normal reaction you would think somebody would do is like jerk it out and hide, but not me. You know, I go ahead and push it through and then I'm like, oh, hey, you probably shouldn't be in here.
Right.
You know, and it didn't, at first there wasn't like a, you should probably shouldn't have done that. It didn't hit me till like later when the dope started to wear off and started getting kind of dope sick because I was out of money and, you know, hadn't figured out how to get my next fix. And I started feeling really, you know, crappy about it. I was like, oh man, you just let an 8-year-old or 9-year-old see you shoot dope, man. That's messed up. You might need to stop this. But see, at that time, I still thought I could stop whenever I wanted to. So, you know, I still had that, like, you got this. And that was probably the first time I self-detoxed myself. Because I did get paid like 2 days later and I could have went and got high, but I waited until like the next week to actually go get high again. I fought it that long, but then I finally gave back in, you know. Mm-hmm. But that was probably the first point where I thought, you know, this is a problem. You know, I don't need to do this anymore. But that was about a year before I actually ended up going to rehab and things started to change. So,
yeah, that's I think, you know, those little moments, and that's obviously not a little moment. That's a big moment, yeah. But there's just like you said, a culmination of things that brought us into our heavy addiction, but they also brought us out. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of signs and indicators that like, man, this isn't working out the way it should be.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's pretty prolific right there, man.
Yeah.
That's a pretty big thing. So how did you find out about recovery? Like what turned you onto that?
Well, the next really big moment happened, like I said, about a year later. I don't know exactly how much later it was, but it was about a year later, roughly. It was in April of 2014. It was actually in the place I'm sitting in right now, not in this particular spot, but downstairs in the bathroom there. It's always a bathroom, it seems like. But my mother, God bless her soul, she is a great woman. I think about my mom, it's the first anchor man where Vince Vaughn's character says Dorothy Mantooth is a saint. That's what I think about my mom.
Yeah,
saint, man. But anyway, she you know, she dealt with it for 20 something years with my dad, and then I go and put her through almost 8 years of it, 7 years of it, you know, having to worry about me. Thank God my brother didn't do the same thing. He's about 11 years younger than me, and you know, he's doing really great, but that's a different story. I get sidetracked. I apologize. But, the second one, it was here and I thought they were on vacation and I was looking for a place to get high. And so I came here and they were supposed to have gone to the beach that day. And so I was just going to, you know, use their bathroom to do my thing. And by the grace of God, they did not. She came in. I had went to Birmingham to get my stuff. And it was right when like the big fentanyl mix with heroin craze hit around 2014. And I remember when I picked it up from that guy, it was gray. And I was like, what is this? I was real skeptical, you know. And he was like, trust me, it's good. He said, just don't do what you normally do. And if, you know, me being the,
yeah,
you know, I was like, of course I'm going to do this. I'm going to probably do double that.
Yeah. Don't threaten me at a good time.
But, I always joked around with a friend of mine in rehab. I said, opiate addicts are the craziest people in the world, man. Cause you hear that somebody died from some dope they got from somebody. You're like, who'd you say you got that from? You know? So I get it and I do about double what I normally would have done because I had had enough to get a good bit that day. And it about killed me, man. I overdosed, and she just happened to come in right after I did it. She found me. She thought I was dead. I was purple. I was rolled back, choking on my tongue, all that stuff. And she called 911. Fortunately, I survived. I kind of came to when she was in there, and that look on her face just like was seared in my mind. And I'll never forget that. I sometimes still see it when I close my eyes. And that's probably what got me through like the first month of rehab, just remembering that, you know? I had a good bit of dope on me, and there was a state trooper that came, and he basically said, you can go get some help because you're going to die, or I can file these charges. And I had enough for felony charges. And at the time I was just like, okay, I don't want to go to prison. So I wish that would have been enough to stop me that day, but I kept getting high until I went to rehab like a week later. I went to rehab about a week later in Florence, Alabama, which is where I live now. And I'm from Jasper, which is where I'm at right now, but which is about 45 minutes north of Birmingham. And the rest is kind of history, man. I got up there. The guys that ran the place, both in recovery, one guy had about 16 years. The other one had about 10. They were incredible, man. They were both former, needle users. And so I just kind of felt like a kinship with them. I just really was like, okay, these guys know where I've been. They know they've probably been further than I'd been, because one of them had done been to prison, and the other one, he was hear his stories. He didn't been shooting people and stuff like that. And I didn't get to the point where I was shooting people. So there's still some hope for me too. So, and they were both, 12-step guys, and they sold me on it, And so I gave it a chance because nothing else had worked. Everything I tried didn't work. So, I gave it a chance, and a few months later I was hooked in, man. The rest is just kind of been, I won't say smooth as butter because that'd be a lie, but it's not been as hard as it could have been. I've seen people really struggle trying to do it without anything, and I can't imagine.
Yeah, that white knuckling, man. I don't see how a lot of people do it. Now, you bring up an interesting point, because you said that, it hadn't been all butter, but it has been, better than it could have been. And, that's kind of the way that I try to remember it, is that no matter what problems I have today, if I just in my mind sprinkle a little dope on them, like pretty obvious, pretty quickly, what's going to be the worst way to go through it? It may not always be peachy, but it will be manageable.
Oh yeah.
Kind of that thing, right?
Yeah. The one of the counselors there at the rehab I went to, he said, there's no problem that you'll face in recovery that is worth using over and compounding it. And it just always stuck with me. It's like, exactly. If I get high, that's just going to make the problem worse. It's never going to get better with me getting high over it. So, if I can just keep that in the back of my head, and bring it forward whenever that stuff goes on. Like last year, it kind of came out of nowhere. And I guess maybe if I'd have been paying attention, I would have seen it coming, but I had so much other stuff going on. I didn't see it, which is on me. And I can admit that, but my ex-wife decided she wanted to get divorced. And here I am knocking on I just getting close to my fifth year mark. And she just comes in and is like, okay, so I don't want to be married to you anymore, And I was just like, oh, well, that hurts, I've seen people get, relapse over a lot less than that. And that's not a pat on my back. I had a lot of support to get me through that. And it wasn't easy. I'm not going to say it was, but by the grace of God, here I sit. Me and her, we maintain a very strong relationship. We're friends. That's not always easy either. But she's in recovery as well. And she's actually about to pick up 7-year chip this coming Saturday. So, nice. You know, yeah. So, you know, and our kids haven't had to suffer through it either. So that's, I have to look at things like that and say, there are some really good positives that come out of me not going and being selfish on this and saying, I'm just going to take care of my emotional state here, you know, which doesn't even take care of it. It just makes it worse. You know, it just delays the inevitable, which is me having to face the consequences of it. So.
Yeah, that's the thing, man, is a relapse may, you know, at the very least, what it will do is just put that problem on hold. Mm-hmm. That's it. That's it. You're going to have to deal with it eventually. You know, when I got clean, I had a arraignment warrant out for me. And I was like, that was in Oklahoma City. And I was down in Altus. That's like the furthest. That's like, you know, just a stone's throw away from the Texas border. So I was really thinking, oh, I could just run from this forever, you know? And, you know, I'm really grateful that I had some people who were being honest with me at the time. They said, you know, well, what are you going to do about your legal thing? I'm like, nothing. They said, no, we work an honest program. Yeah. We're going to have to deal with it. And that's what they kind of like instilled in me at the time is that like relapse, continued drug use, whatever the case may be, those problems still exist regardless. Nothing goes away. You know, even if in the physical sense, let's say just by some miracle, the court clerk lost my case, I would still be stuck with that in my heart, right? Like in my head that I didn't do something, you know, the way that I should have done then. Right. And so, and that's awesome though. So what's your clean date?
May 28th of
May 28th,
2014.
Congratulations, man. That's
huge. I did go to rehab. I know I mentioned April and then going to rehab a week later. So this is how I'll give you kind of the quick rundown of how I found out that I was selfish and self-centered. Cause I'm sure you've had this experience too. A lot of alcoholics and drug addicts, when they first start to get clean, they don't think they're selfish and self-centered. I sponsored a lot of guys and they never realize that. I mean, they never want to come to that, you know, that realization.
Yeah, I shared my dope. What do you mean I'm selfish? You know, I used to get people high all the time.
I'm sharing with all my friends, man. I'm not selfish. You know, that brings up another thought to me too. I used to tell my sponsor all the time, I was pretty bad, but I didn't steal from anybody. And I guess he got sick of me saying that one time. And he said, "You think your mom ever lost sleep over you being out, being out running the roads?" And I was like, "Yeah." And he's like, "You reckon you stole some time and peace of mind from her?" And I was like, "Oh, you son of a." But he was right, you know. Yeah. Yeah,
that's great.
But eventually I got honest with him about, you know, me having stolen stuff. I just didn't want to admit it at first. But, you know, it takes a little while to be fully honest about things. But yeah, I went to rehab April 28th. I'm sorry, I said May 28th. It's May 23rd. I went to rehab on April 28th. And then my brother, he's 11 years younger than me. He actually graduated in 2014 from high school. And his graduation date was the 22nd. And so they let me go on pass a week early, which they normally, you had to be there a month. And I had only been there 3 weeks. And, you know, instead of like helping my mom get things ready and, you know, being there for my brother and all this, I spent the whole afternoon looking for dope, you know. And I finally, I had spent the few weeks I was there hustling up some money so that I could buy some, you know. I mean, I did all kind of stuff from, you know, like trading bags of chips and ramen noodles and everything else and then selling them back to people and all this. I mean, I did all kind of stuff to hustle up that money just so that I could buy one bag of dope because I knew I was going to be on that pass. And anyway, so I finally found it about an hour before the actual graduation, and I made it to the graduation, but I was high, man, you know? And so this is a day for my brother, and it's his graduation day. And instead of being there helping him and helping my mom, I go get high. And it didn't dawn on me at the time. It didn't dawn on me until I got back and I was sitting in a meeting and somebody was sharing something from their life about them doing something kind of similar, being selfish and self-centered. And I was just like, oh my God, I am selfish and self-centered, you know? Yeah. And so, that was it, man. I was like, man, but talk about being honest. It took me almost 2 years to tell my sponsor about that. So
that's a tough one, man.
Yeah.
That's a tough. So that you didn't, they never found out at the rehab.
No. Normally they test you when you come back. We always did, but for whatever reason, I didn't get tested that time. And which is, again, by the grace of God, because if I had, I'd have got kicked out. I didn't have anywhere to go. So right. I would have just been stuck up there. I would have ended up with a warrant out for my arrest and stuck 2 hours away. And my mom wouldn't have come got me. She was done with me at that point. So, I mean, yeah, I don't know. It's just... it worked in my favor. It don't always work like that for people. And, you know, sometimes I think when it does, you just got to kind of take advantage of it and be grateful, because it don't always go like that for people.
Yeah, no, it doesn't. You're lucky that you didn't overdose, man.
Yeah.
You know, after a month gone, you know, cause we tend to pick right back up where we left off.
Oh yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. That was one of the worst bags of dope I've ever had.
Really?
And I'm very grateful for that.
Yeah, they say the 12 steps will fuck up your high, and they're not lying, man. You know? They're not lying. There's nothing like having a head full of AA in a dope house and trying to maneuver your way through it, man. It just doesn't, it's not pretty. It sucks.
No.
Right on. So, you're coming up on, what is that? This will be your seventh year. You'll be getting your seventh in May.
Right, yeah.
7 years, man. Yeah, that's
God willing, if I don't get in the way and mess it up.
Yeah, right. Just for today is what we got. Now, what would you say, you know, kind of your, and I know if you're anything like me, when you were using, politics was the furthest thing from your attention, but what would you say, you know, has kind of brought you to where you're at today politically?
Okay, so politics. Prior to the 2016 election, I didn't care anything about politics at all. I don't even think I paid much attention. Other than I know where most of my family stands, and they make their decisions based on religious, you know, principle. You know, they're pretty much single issue voters. They're against abortion, so they vote that way. That's my family, you know?
Right.
And that's their business. I don't really discuss politics with them anyway, so it doesn't matter. And I have a couple of cousins who are on the other side of the fence. They're not single issue voters, but they vote Democrat, which is a rarity in Alabama, at least in my experience. But as far as me, prior to 2016, I'd never even voted because I didn't care, you know, even before I started drinking and doing drugs, I just didn't care. It didn't matter to me. I hated politics. I hated talking about politics. I hated thinking about politics. I had to take a class on socialism. It was a requirement when I was my first year in college, and it really, I don't know, that professor really made me angry about politics, because there was no real discussion. It was just, this is right and everything else is wrong. And I don't know, my experience in there was, I just really didn't enjoy it. So after that, I just really didn't want to talk about politics. And especially when you start drinking and doing stuff, man, people get in fist fights over stupid stuff like that.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah. So one of my rules when I was drinking was no religion, no politics. You know, we're going to enjoy this. Right. So, you know, as long as people stay away from that, we were usually pretty good. And no football. I mean, you can't in Alabama. You can't talk about football when you're drinking because it's always Alabama and Auburn fans, and somebody gets in a fist fight. Oh, and it's stupid because Alabama's clearly the better team. Roll Tide. But anyway, yeah. But 2016 came along, and here we've got like the mayor, the chick mayor or chick governor from Black Sheep versus Biff from Back to the Future 2. And I mean, who are you going to vote for, you know? And I'm just at that point, I'm like, this is so ridiculous. I have to start paying attention because how did we get here? You know, I don't know. I guess Hillary Clinton wasn't quite as much a surprise as Donald Trump was, but I don't know. I was just so shocked that was the two choices that it came down to. And I probably shouldn't have been. I just had never really paid attention. So the only thing I really knew was that every Republican was a racist. At least that's what you hear, is every Republican is a racist and Democrats want to give you free stuff. So and say everybody else is a racist. So and it's only every election cycle, right? So then nothing really happens in the in-between, you know, just a little bit of stuff to keep people kind of at bay, but it really heats up in election year. It's, you know, Republicans are racist and Democrats want to give you stuff and they're all communists and socialists. So, I mean, up until 2016, I started kind of paying attention, but I really hadn't developed like a philosophical position or hadn't really pinned down where I was, you know. I knew I didn't like either of the major parties. I didn't care for either of them. I thought they were all just awful and they didn't align with any of my personal positions. As I started reading about different ideologies and stuff like that, and I started listening to different speakers and stuff, I come across Milton Friedman and started listening to a lot of him. And then from him, I found Thomas Sowell. And really, Thomas Sowell was the one who probably got me more into, I guess, libertarian ideals. And I don't even think, I don't know, with Sowell, I don't know that that's so much his purpose. You know, he's just kind of like an economics guy. But the way he talks about it, and it's just kind of like anti-government intervention in economically principled things. And me working in a government position, it really kind of moved me into that where I found my home. Because I started like researching things that aligned with what he was talking about, and that's where I found it, you know? Yeah. And so then I start seeing this word libertarian, and I'm like, okay, so what is this? And then I really started doing a little bit more research. So it's only been like 2 years that I've really been kind of digging into like the philosophy of it and trying to learn. And I still feel like I'm really new as far as all that goes. And, you know, I'm just kind of scratching the surface, but part of what I do at my job is get people out of poverty. You know, we pull people out of prison and we work with people who get alcohol and drug related offenses. And most of these people are in or around the poverty line or way under it, you know, and they've never learned how to do anything different. And so when you start trying to teach these people how to not do those things, and they're like, but government hand me money, you know?
Yeah.
And when I first started there, about 4 years ago, I was like, okay, well, we use the government to help you until you can get back on your feet. And I realized really quickly that doesn't help, because when you go that route, the government cuts that off really quickly when they start working.
Yep.
You know, all that government assistance, there's like a huge gap from government assistance to, you know, making enough money to sustain yourself. So like that interim in between, the government really just kind of, you know, hits you right in the back end and says, oh, if you're right here, you can go F yourself.
Yeah.
So if you ever heard Thomas Sowell's story about working with, I think it's the Peanuts in Puerto Rico, and the U.S. government was helping to fund it, and he had proposed a solution that would make it more efficient, and they all just looked at him like he was crazy. And that was kind of when he realized that the government wasn't trying to be efficient. That mixed with my experience, you know, working in and with the government, just kind of let me know I don't trust anything about what they're doing because they're not trying to help people.
No, and it's like you said, man, our welfare programs incentivizes people to stay in the exact position that they're in. They're pigeonholed. You know, if you make a one penny over the allotted amount that they're given, you know, saying, hey, you got to stay under this line. If you make 1 cent over that, you lose everything. And that 1 cent threshold, hell, we could even say $1,000 a year threshold, like that is still crippling poverty, you know, like it's still way under the line. So not only are they still in a bad economic position, but now they don't have the help that they had beforehand. And so it's like, yeah, it's a no-brainer to see why it doesn't work. But and just to kind of go onto your latter point about government efficiency, you know, I've never worked directly for the government, but I've done construction pretty much all my life, right? And out here in Oklahoma, I worked for a road construction company. We built
nice
roads. And every time we got a city job, that job was instantly bid at least double what it would be if it was a private. And the reason being is because if you bid too low, the government won't accept it. They won't take the contract because their reasoning is that, oh, you must not be willing to give us the quality that we want. And it's insane. I mean, everything on that job site's bid, you know, two times over, every pay item on those blueprints. And so,
Before I went to rehab, I did construction work, and any commercial stuff we did on federal buildings, same thing.
Oh yeah.
Always bid high.
Payday. Payday right there.
I'll never forget. Our boss was always like, federal job. So we did a lot down in Montgomery. And it was just, we always made extra money down there. It was good for the workers too. I was just a laborer. But we always got paid extra when we worked down there because
they
got extra.
Yeah, you pay scale, don't they? I think on something like that. Yeah. And that's kind of the deal, man. Anything around here that's like attached to the public, there's a union involved somewhere. Mm-hmm. All the union jobs go to the, you know, city work or government work. And So, well, right on, man. Sounds like you have really turned your life around. You know, I'm glad to hear that you've turned on to libertarianism. I mean, even if you're just like 2 years into it, hell, I'm fairly new to it myself, but I think we can really mind fuck this thing, you know, to the point of it being not useful to anybody, including ourselves. And the more simplistic that we make it, the better off we are.
Yeah. You know,
don't hurt people. Don't take their stuff, you know?
Right.
Just keep it real simple with that. We're going to be all right, man. Mm. Well, man, and this is one other thing before we get off here. If you could talk to that person, let's just say you back in 2014 in April, what are some words of advice that you can give people who are struggling to find a way out? Here we are, we're brand new year, 2021. A lot of people are examining themselves right now. What's something that you would like to say to them?
You mean somebody struggling with addiction?
Or yeah.
Just in general.
Or in general too, but primarily with addiction.
Primarily with addiction, I would say don't trust what you think. That was always my biggest issue the first probably 6 months, is everything that I thought, you know, everything going on up here in my head was so far detached from reality that I just couldn't trust it, you know, and I had to bank on the people like my sponsor and the guys at the rehab that were my counselors to really guide me there. And I've seen it so many times. I worked at that rehab for about a year and a half after I graduated there, roughly. And I saw so many guys that come through there, and they would put together 6, 7, 8 months, 9 months, and then they would just get this really unreasonable ideas and stuff going on in their head, and they couldn't shake it, you know, and there was no reasoning with them to be like, this is not reality, you know, let's stay focused in reality. But they weren't hearing it, you know. So that would be the thing I would say is, you know, don't trust what you're thinking. Trust the people who've been doing it a while, because they obviously got something right. You know, they got, if they didn't, they wouldn't be sober. So, you know, until you can trust what you're thinking, don't trust what you're thinking. So.
Ooh, that's a good one, man. There's a, and the fellowship that I attend, there's a guy, he's long passed now. His name was Greg P. And he had this saying. He talked about when he first came in the rooms, 95% of the shit that went through his head was complete nonsense. And he says, he said, every year that he stayed clean, he got a percent of that back. So, you know, after 10 years, he only had 85% of the stuff rattling around his head was BS. And that's progress. That's good. But it's still, you know, it's important to note that, man, none of us have it figured out, you know, and especially when we first come in the rooms like we do, we have nothing. We don't know what the hell's going on. And it's okay to listen to somebody else, give some direction for once.
Well, yeah. And on that, I would like to add too, I still don't trust everything that I think, you know, I still talk to my sponsor 3 or 4 or 5 days a week, depending on the week and how it's going. And, you know, I still talk to those counselors from time to time, and, you know, 'cause I'm friends with them, and, I send people to them when they're, you know, need rehab and stuff like that. And, you know, so if I ever have any questions or anything that just doesn't seem or feel right, you know, 'cause, you know, things are all about spirituality too. And sometimes you can just feel when things are off. Then I rely on those outlets, because that's what I've come to trust.
Yeah,
this up here, this will get me messed up in a hurry. My head messed up in a hurry. So,
yeah,
you know, it's not safe up there. It's not safe at all. So, but I see so many people in early recovery that just rely wholeheartedly on their head, and it's so dangerous, man. So many people relapse over trusting their head that it, you know, it's sad.
It is. I mean, the problem is I think too, is that a lot of our defects of character are just, you know, survival skills that we picked up out there. The problem is we don't need them anymore once we get clean, you know. Trusting our head got us in the spot that we were in. So, words of wisdom, man. Well, Benevolus, thank you so much for showing up and talking with us, man.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Absolutely. All right. And we will, we'll have to get you on again at some point in the future if you'd be up for it.
Yeah. Yeah. No doubt. Just anytime, just holler at me, man.
All right. Take it easy.
See you, man.
All right. And there we have it. How'd you guys enjoy that? I like talking to people like that. I like talking about recovery. I like talking about what it was like and what it's like for them now. And, just hearing some of that hope, you know, that's always good. Good to hear, man. I draw strength from that, because, you know, the fact of the matter is I'm not always going to be in the best mental state of mind to be able to handle, you know, the world around me. But when somebody like, you know, Benevolus shares a story, you know, I can derive hope and energy and strength from that. And, yeah, that was just a cool episode, man. I love doing those interviews. So, yeah, there you have it. I just want to take a moment to also remind you guys that my DMs are still always open, no matter what. If you want somebody to talk to, if you're looking at getting into recovery, trying to find a new way to live, you know, feel free to reach out. You know, I can get you hooked up with some people in your local area. If you're wondering whether or not this is the year that you're going to turn it all around and change, I'm here to tell you that you can and you will. You know, you just have to participate. That's all you got to do. All you got to do is show up. So leave it at that. And yeah, before we get into the song of the day, just want to remind everybody that this show will continue to share these types of stories and continue to really highlight areas of the libertarian movement that want to see an end to the war on drugs. So if you or anybody you know you think would be a good fit for this, feel free to reach out. Utilize that voicemail feature on Anchor FM. You know, leave a message and let me know who it is, or, you know, if it's you, just, yeah, reach out to me, man. I'd love to bring you on and have you talk with us. So with that, going to go into the song of the day. And today, I can't remember if I've played this song before or not. I had a playlist going for a little bit. I need to go back through all my episodes and check out what songs have been played and what ones haven't. But so if this is a repeat, I apologize. But this is a band called Days and Days, and they are kind of the new face of, you know, underground punk rock of this current generation. And I love it, man. It's like anti-folk, I think is what they call it, or folk punk or whatever. There's a million different names for the genre. But this is a song called Wholesale Failure. And it talks about being just completely stuck in this frame of mind where nothing's worthwhile, everything sucks, and yada, yada, yada. But at the end, you know, it's kind of them realizing that, you know what, today is the day that I can make that change. And today I have every opportunity to not be a wholesale failure. And yeah, I don't know. It's a fun song. Yeah, I love the lyrics, and just it's gritty, man. So with that, I'm going to leave you guys with Days and Days, Wholesale Failure.
What the fuck? Would it matter if I died one time, then this guy will still be blue. I'm no catalyst for change, just another pretty thing taking up a minimum. Everything's so fucking comical, we need a drag. The worst parts that I know this isn't even close to how devastating bad everything is gonna get. Would it matter if we just quit breathing, our hearts could keep beating, and it's a thing twice? Life's a gamble and tomorrow's never promised, so fuck it, I feel it's rolling dice. Everything's so fucked, it's comical, waking up to drag. The worst part, but I know this isn't even close to how devastatingly sad everything is gonna get. So underwhelming when all that I can think about is how the story ends and all the lessons that I've yet to learn. There's a future, the best part, stuck up between the only things that I'm uncomfortable with. Every single second of it that I would before everything gets to hell in a handbag. Time will keep on ticking, the earth will keep on spinning. Despite what we want, we are what we fear, what we feel, what day we almost die. Take one more breath and say goodbye. So why the fuck do we obsess over success and failure as long as we're breathing? We're all right. So here's to conceding, I'm aware now I'm part of the life. Everything's so fucking comical, waking up in drag. Best parts right now, we're still alive, we can reach.